Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I am one of your hosts, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Hi, Paul.
Well, hello, Susan. Today, we have the honor of hosting a roundtable of directors of four of the historical societies from surrounding towns here in Story County and in Boone. We'll be talking about when, where, and why the towns were founded and who those founders were. And I want to introduce our guest today. On my immediate right, as you can see on your home monitor, we have Pam Schwartz of Boone, Kate Feil of the Historical Society in Story City, Barb Mellon from Slater, and Nels Nord of Huxley. And they're going to be telling us about the founding of their towns today and how those things came to be and why and where and who. And we'll start now with Pam Schwartz of Boone. And Pam, how is Boone founded? Take us back to the earliest days.
Well, it's a bit of a complicated story. It really starts in 1835 with the Dragoon soldiers. So after the Louisiana Purchase, the soldiers are kind of sent out to check out the local, you know, the different areas. I shouldn't say local, but because Iowa wasn't really much of a thing yet. But in 1835, the Dragoon soldiers come through, and with them is Captain Nathan Boone, who is son of famous Daniel Boone. Many people might be familiar with him. And also with him is a man by the name of Charles Gaston. And that Charles Gaston really seems to have taken to Boone when they came through initially and ends up coming back. So the Dragoons come through in 1835, and then in 1846 is when Charles Gaston comes back to the area and settles. He actually settles at Sweet Point, now towards modern-day Madrid. And that's kind of the beginning of it all. The same year is when we have our first white settler in the Des Moines Township. So that's sort of the beginning there. By 1851, the population's starting to grow. You know, we've got a few hundred people in the area by then, all sort of word of mouth. In 1851, the people sort of petitioned to get to become the county seat of Boone County. And so Boonesboro becomes sort of the first makings of what later becomes Boone. So 1851, we have Boonesboro. A lot of different things happen throughout the 1850s. Buildings are made, buildings come down, new things are made. A lot of the initial offices and things were kept in homes. And then by 1865, we have the coming of the railroad through Iowa. And I think that's something that a lot of us can identify with here, is the big difference that the railroad made. So they entered into John Insley Blair, which is a familiar name of most people in this area. They enter into sort of working on agreements with the railroad and with Boonesboro to bring the railroad through and have a depot. And long story short, they're not able to come to an agreement. Boonesboro's not really putting forth the money or they think the effort to get the railroad to come through. So Mr. Blair decides he's just going to build a whole new town. So he goes east of town and builds, and that's how we come to have Boone. So Boone gets the depot, really sort of debilitates the county seat of Boonesboro because they don't have it. There's not good traffic between the two. A lot of muddy roads, a lot of problems with travel between. So it was kind of a big source of contention for the two communities for quite a while. The biggest, I think, source of contention was that Boonesboro had a post office and Boone did not. And people in Boone didn't like to have to try to figure out how to get over to Boonesboro in order to get their mail. So eventually, Boone does get a post office, but there's already another post office nearby in Dallas County called Boone. So they decide, well, we're just going to change our name because we want our post office and we want our town to have the same name. And so they end up choosing Montana. And everybody says, well, how in the world did they choose the name Montana? A couple of the townspeople had recently been visiting family in Montana, and they thought it sounded nice. So we end up with, instead of Boonesboro and Boone, we end up with Boonesboro and Montana. And so Montana was such for about 5 years or so, and then eventually they went back to Boone. Eventually the two towns came together and became what we know as Boone proper. So that is, you know, the shortest version possible.
That is fascinating.
There's a lot more to it.
Who would have thought that Montana would be mentioned today in the And that is just a great story of how it was founded. We all know about the Dragoon Trail through Iowa, and that's brand new to me. I didn't know about Nathan Boone being Daniel
Which,
Boone's
of course,
son.
Of course, kind of becomes our namesake if you hadn't already made that connection.
Right. Well, I see you get up in the morning and you hope to learn something, and I do learn.
And it's so early. You've gotten so much more of the day
yes,
to go.
Yes, I'm just dying to know what I'll know by noon.
Or by 8 o'clock.
Yeah, we want to move on now to Barb Mallon of Slater. And Barb, welcome to our program today. And you can talk about the early days of Slater.
Well, thank you for having me. Slater also has an interesting history in the fact that we started about the same time as Pam is talking about with Boone, only the name of the town is Sheldahl. And Sheldahl existed because it was on the Chicago Northwestern Railroad line. And in about 1870s, the Chicago-Milwaukee-St. Paul line was being surveyed, and they thought it was going to go right through Sheldahl and connect with the Chicago Northwestern. But after they did the surveying and checking things out, they said no, it was going to be too hard to cross the Skunk and the Des Moines Rivers. And so they moved it a mile and a half north. And so now the Chicago Northwestern was going to intersect with the Chicago-Milwaukee and St. Paul line a mile and a half north of Sheldahl. Well, the people that lived in Sheldahl were very upset. Sheldahl has a kind of a unique history in itself because it's located in three counties. One quarter of it is in Story County, one quarter is in Boone County, and the south half of it is in Polk County. And, of course, they wanted to keep their entity and their identity, but the people in the Story County half said, no, we're going to move. We have to be up where the railroad is because we have produce, we have stock, we have goods, we have ways that we have to get to the railroad, and we can't go over the muddy roads, just like Pam was talking about. It was making it too difficult. Well, the upcoming businessmen in Sheldahl said, you know, I think we're going to have to move, else we're going to be doomed. And so they decided to take a vote, and only the people in Story County voted to move their businesses and their homes. And they did that over a course of about 3 or 4 years, and they moved them by wagons, and they moved them by the circular horsepower, by putting buildings on skids and moving them. And it sometimes would take a week to 10 days to get them moved up to the Slater area. So they finally get them moved up near the depot and near the watchtower for the railroad line. And the person who owned the property up there, his name was A.M. Jenks. And Mr. Jenks was not just an opportunist, but he was very interested in making the town successful. And because he owned most of the land, he had it platted and he had it surveyed, and he developed blocks in the town. And so he was very interested in making the town successful. So he did a couple of things. He devoted at least 1 acre for a school, 1 acre for a park, and he had lots for 2 churches. And then he promised anybody who moved a business or a house to Slater that they would get a free lot. And so about 52, 53 people moved either their homes or their businesses to that area, which at that time was called Sheldahl Crossing. And they moved, and it took them several years. But by 1889, most of the homes and businesses had been moved. And they were finally decided that 1889 was their founding date, which makes us 125 years old. And then in 1890, and actually is on April 7th of 1890, we were incorporated. The town was still called Sheldahl Crossing, and people didn't really like that name. And they thought there should be something a little bit better than that. They didn't want it named Jenks, which was the owner of all the land. That didn't sound very exciting. And they thought about naming it after one of the founding fathers, who was Ole Nelson. But they didn't really want that either. And Mr. Jenks decided to name it Slater after a friend out east. So our name doesn't have a lot of significance, and it's not as exciting as you'd like it to be, but that's how we got our name, and that's how we got started. And we still have a very close kinship with our sister city of Sheldahl because of that. And we did celebrate our 125th anniversary last year during our 4th of July celebration, which we can talk about later. We have a lot of celebrations there.
That's fantastic. All these things are new. I didn't know about them before. And Slater It could have been so many other things. Man, that's interesting. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Now we're going to move on to the person who is involved with the Historical Society in my hometown, Story City, Kate File, and welcome this morning. Kate, welcome today to the show. And you can tell us about the origins of Story City.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. It's been interesting to hear that we've all kind of had a different town name to start out with because Story City did as well. People first came to what we now call Story City around 1852, 1853 to check out the land and see, you know, what could be done there. In 1855, they decided to plat a town, and it had such a pretty view that they called it Fairview. So, and it was right along the Skunk River, and it was about 13 acres to begin with, and that was in Lafayette Township. And not very many people lived actually in Fairview proper, the town at first. When our first mayor of Story City came in 1856, he said only two people lived there. And most of the people lived along the Skunk, either on the north or south side of the town there. So that was kind of interesting. So we had most of the original people were from either New York, Pennsylvania, or Indiana that had come over to that part of Story County. In 1855-56, we kind of started to have the Norwegian contingent come over, and that happened. They were coming originally from Illinois. They had a big group that came over in 1857 and originally landed in Lisbon, Illinois. And then in the 60s, we had some of the Danish contingent come over, too. So we're kind of a mix up there of several Scandinavian countries, if you will, for immigrants. In 1857, they built a post office. And at that point, they discovered that there was already a Fairview on the books. So they needed to also change their name. So, and we were Story County after the Chief Justice Joseph Story. So they decided to go with Story City in honor of him as well. So a lot of people think it would happen when Story City was actually founded in 1881 that the name was changed, but it was actually really early on. So that was interesting for me to find out as well. In 1878, again, railroad was a big deal for Story City, too. The railroad was going to come through, and it was going to be farther west of town. So they started moving the town over for the railroad. A lot of the town, or some of the buildings were moved from Fairview, or what was originally Fairview. And they had a new guy plat the town of Story City, which we're kind of proud of because of the wide streets, and you know this, Paul.
Yeah, we have very wide streets in Story City.
We really do.
So someone platted it that way. It's always been wide, and that's terrific. I didn't know that either, and I come from there.
In one of the things I was reading recently in a 1940 publication, they were saying that somebody, whoever platted them in 1878 must have knew that we were going to have cars, so we needed the extra parking, right? So the town was actually incorporated, and this included both of the, you know, the newer Story City and Fairview in 1881.
Fantastic background, and it's fascinating how the name of the town evolved. Everyone thought Fairview was wonderful, and then they checked, and there already was a Fairview, so you got to go with Plan B.
Plan B, yes.
Well, Story City is really Plan B. Well, moving on, we're going to go to another town in our area here. We have Nels Nord of Huxley, and welcome, Nels. Tell
Thank
us about Huxley and how that began.
Well, in 1855, southeast of Huxley, about a mile, 165 Norwegian families settled in that area and bought land for $1.25 an acre. In 1882, S.S. Merrill was the owner of the Milwaukee Land Company. They were putting a railroad through. So they platted about 30 homes there just north of the railroad, and that's how Huxley was started. It was named after S.S. Merrill's uncle in England. He was a noted biologist and author, Thomas Henry Huxley, and that's how Huxley got its name. In 1882, then it became the town. It wasn't incorporated until 1902, and then they built, in the late 1800s, they built the downtown Huxley, and that became kind of the hub for the Norwegian immigrants to trade. Huxley now is from 199 people in 1902. It's about 3,700.
Boy, that's quite a bit of growth. Very interesting how these towns got their names.
Yes, it is.
And that's probably obscure to most people who live there.
Yeah.
If you had a question and answer session, or if they were on Jeopardy, and name why your town has its name, probably 5% of the people would know the answer to that question. But yes, I see a thread running through this whole founding process for all these communities. Number one, the railroad's importance. Number two, ethnic groups and, groups of people from specific countries. In my case, of course, my grandfather, it's actually kind of strange. My grandfather was born in 1850. Not my great-grandfather, my grandfather. He had six children. His first wife passed away. He married my grandmother and had six more, and he passed away in 1925. But I know that he was born in Illinois, and there was the Norwegians came over, and then they would trek to Illinois, where there was this sort of beachhead that was established, and then men would go out from there to homestead in the West, in Iowa. And that's what happened to him. And they were the Henrysons. That's on my mother's side. And then they're sort of founders of the community. And what you have here is just the essence of moving west, founding, establishing a community where there was none before. And this is something we honor. And that's why all of you folks are involved, because you're in charge of a historical society. And one thing I noticed from the time I grew up in the 50s, it was right after the war. Everything was new. You know, the storefronts had to be changed. Everything was new. Now, I don't remember anyone going antiquing in the 50s. Now we seem to value that. We're back in touch with our history, at least in Story City and probably in your towns. There are people who, through the Main Street program, are really renovating, and a lot of their buildings are looking back on the original building, and they're trying to achieve the appearance of what it was years and years ago. So look how our values have changed, and look how we are getting back in touch with our history and where we came from. And I know that each of you has a lot of commemorative events and things that happen in your community that are annual, and this is your chance to promote them and talk about them. And we'll start again with Boone. And Pam, what goes on in Boone?
All sorts of stuff. This year we're actually celebrating a big milestone, which is our sesquicentennial. So that's 150 years. Now, again, our story is kind of, Boonesboro is a little bit older, but when we talk about sort of actual Boone proper, becoming a town in 1865, that's kind of the date we're commemorating. So we're celebrating 150 years this year, and we're still working on a lot of the things that are going to go with that. The Historical Center is going to be doing some special programming, or we're going to be having an exhibit. A lot of that is still in the works. I know the Boone News Republican, our newspaper, is doing a lot of special feature stories. We're doing a lot of historical stories, a lot of those sort of way back when type of snippets. And then we're also working on some other things in the community. Now, that's sort of our special thing. But then another one of our ongoing celebrations that we have every single year that will be focusing on commemorating the sesquicentennial will be our Pufferbilly Days. Now, Pufferbilly Days is sort of generally a celebration of our railroad heritage.
That's always September, isn't it?
Yep, and that's always September and will be again this year. So we're working on some different ways that we can really incorporate the sesquicentennial into, an already existent celebration as well. So those are sort of the main things we have going on this year. And like I said, stay tuned, because we have a lot of things in the mix. And I think by this fall, we're going to have a lot of great things to do. We're hoping to do some downtown walking tours. The downtown of Boone, originally we would have had two downtowns, one in West, one in Boone proper. So now we just really have the one, and the buildings have just changed so much over the years, and things have gone in and things have come out, and buildings have gone up and been renovated. So there's a lot to talk about in one of those sort of just the downtown tours. We could, focus entire programs on just what has been in those buildings and what has passed through. So those are the main celebrations we're working on this year. And Pufferbilly's really our biggest sort of annual event.
And then you have the Mamie Eisenhower home.
Yep.
A lot of folks don't realize that Mamie Eisenhower, President Eisenhower's wife, was from Boone.
Yep.
And they preserved her home there. In fact, the street's named after her, Mamie Eisenhower.
Mamie Eisenhower Avenue,
yeah,
absolutely.
That's right.
It's one of our main thoroughfares there. And we've got the historic house and museum and a lot of renovations actually You know, that's something that we're kind of personally celebrating this year is all the renovations we've done to the Eisenhower birthplace and new exhibits and all sorts of different things we'll be having.
So. Our historical building is very good sized, beautiful
it's
building.
It's enormous. Yeah, it was a Masonic temple built in 1907. So it's pretty historic itself. And it's kind of an institution just right there on the main Story Street in the downtown area. So it's very large, lots of exhibits.
Well, you know, that's terrific. I've been in there, and it's very impressive. And the building itself is impressive. It's just a great building and a nice era, too, of architecture. Mm-hmm. So you're lucky to have that building in Boone and using it for the things you're using it for. Well, Barb Mellon of Slater, what's happening at Slater? What typically goes on there in the space of a year?
Well, it's always interesting on the 4th of July because we do have a major celebration. And it started out with Slater and Sheldahl alternating years to host the 4th of July. And Slater was the first. And then long about maybe 5 years ago, the celebrations became so large there might be 10,000 people in the town of Sheldahl, which only has two major streets going into and out of. So it was very difficult for Sheldahl to host it. Plus, they had lost a lot of their population and the people who could actually do the work to put on a celebration. And so Slater decided that we would take it over every year with the Sheldahl people helping in Slater to put it on. So we always have a major parade and activities and a lot of events going on. When we had our centennial 25 years ago, it was a huge celebration, and it was planned for a couple of years, and it was successful because almost everybody in town had a part in it. Everybody had to cooperate and do something to make it work. So our 125th celebration, people just looked at that and said, I don't have the energy to do that kind of a celebration again. And we didn't. But we did have one event that was sponsored by the Historical Association, and that was to have a contest for people to design a city flag. And so we now have an official city flag for the city of Slater.
Well, what's the flag like? What look like?
Well, it represents the railroad. Mm-hmm. And so it shows its basic colors of black and gold, which some people accuse us of having Hawkeye colors, which Nelson and I approve of. But it is a look. It appears to be a train, looking oncoming train, and it is something that we're very proud of. And we had a high school student won that contest.
Great, so, a high school student won the contest.
Yes, we had 15 different designs. And there were young children who did little colored drawings, and there were adults who did very professional-looking drawings. But our high school student won it, Maggie Reyes. And so we are celebrating the 125 years kind of last year and this year both, because that is kind of our heritage.
So there will be a big celebration on the 4th of July.
There will be another celebration
on the 4th of July. And a parade and all that. Do you have fireworks,
too? Fireworks, too. Oh, that's our big thing.
Remember that Slater coming up July 4th, another extension of your 125th celebration.
That is. Another part of that heritage, though, is our Slater Nighthawks, our baseball team.
Tell me about the Nighthawks. They're a legend, aren't they?
They are a legend. They have been around. We have pictures of, like, the 1920 team. And we have some of the old gloves that they used, and you wondered how they ever caught a ball with it. You know, our history with the Slater Nighthawks is very rich. We have all the trophies that they won, photographs. We have scorebooks. We have a lot of people still in the community who played on that team. One of the persons who just recently passed away at the end of December had a claim to fame in that he hit the first home run out of the Nighthawk Park.
Wow. That's great. That's a great story. The Nighthawks, you know, it's a story in and of itself. And each of these communities, I'm sure, has a legend or a thing that they're known for, or someone notorious in their past, or something that,
that too
developed into some sort of an institution. And moving over to Kate File from Story City. Kate, tell us about what happens in Story City every year, or this year, too.
Well, this year will be our 50th anniversary of Scandinavian News, which I'm sure you're aware of, Paul. So we're excited about that. And Scandinavian Days originally started with 17. Maj, which is the Norwegian Constitution Day, or May 17th. So then they eventually as last year, we had snow in May, and weather is a little iffy in May still. They moved it into June, so it's always the first weekend in June. And I think they started in 1955, started to incorporate the other nationalities as well from the other Scandinavian countries that were in the town. So we're excited about that. We'll have our parade like we do every year. And the Historical Society is in charge of the 5K run walk. So if you're interested in being, you know, active during the first weekend in June, you can check out Scandi5K.com and you can register there. And we are also doing at the Carriage House Museum, we'll have a kind of exhibit on the last 50 years of Scandinavian days and what's happened. A lot of great photos and stuff we've had from past parades and past activities. So it should be an interesting event. And they're actually working on working with a Renaissance fair group to kind of hopefully bring in some Viking reenactors, which we think would be really interesting.
Well, I hope they don't start to pillage and destroy. That would be a blow to Story City's heritage.
Yeah.
Oh, the Vikings are loose.
Right.
Now, how many? There are several sites in Story City that are museums, actually, aren't there?
That is correct, yes. We do have four. We started out on Main Street in a little brick building that used to be the City Waterworks plant, and that started in 1982 in that building. And then we kind of progressed through the years. We purchased and moved the Sheldahl Schoolhouse from the Riverside Bible Camp in 1990 and moved that to just basically across the street from our first museum. And we refurbished that, and it's you know, it decorated as a schoolhouse would have been when it was used, which was 1860 to 1885. And then they purchased a home on Grand Avenue, which was H.T. Henryson's home, who possibly you're related to.
I'm related.
Yeah. So they were the Henrysons was the group. Torkel, his father, was in charge of bringing that first group in 1847 over to Lisbon, Illinois, and then on to Iowa after that. And then in 2008, we built the Carriage House Museum, which is a brand new building directly behind the Henryson House. And it's got a great storage space and exhibit space for new exhibits. So,
yeah, it's a beautiful facility. And then we have to talk about the antique carousel.
Of course, yeah.
Ooh.
It was 100 years old in 2013. So
it's an interesting story about how they acquired that, too.
It is. Do you want to tell it?
No, you go ahead.
They actually, built in 1913, and a gentleman, is he from Grundy Center that had it, I believe? And he would tour it around the area. And in 1938, I believe it was, he already had a book somewhere else, and they always had it for 4th of July, correct? At that time, Story City would either host it or Lake Comar would host it, the recreation area south of Story City. And they really wanted it, so they just decided to buy it from the guy. So the town purchased the carousel, and we've had it ever since. So, yeah.
And they've got a beautiful facility it was housed in. And the remarkable thing is, in the 80s, how quickly they raised the money to refurbish all the beautiful animals that are made of wood and carved, and also to build a facility to house that.
So
right. Remarkable how quickly they were able to do that. So the carousel is a big highlight of Story City. And now moving on to Nels Nord. There's a Scandinavian name. Tell us about what's happening in Huxley during the years.
Well, this will be the 23rd year of Prairie Festival, and it started out in 1987 as Oofta Days, but it was changed to
Oofta Days.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah. But it didn't. I don't know why it changed. I don't recall why it changed, but it started at Prairie Days, and it's held in the fourth. I think it's the fourth weekend in August, and it's a 2-day festivities of entertainment. Bands, they spend quite a bit of money in promoting it.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Today, we've been speaking with Pam Schwartz of the Boone County Historical Society, Kate File of the Story City Historical Society, Barb Mallon of the Slater Area Historical Association, and Nels Nord of the Huxley Historical Society. Before we turn to the challenges faced by historical societies today, let's take a break with Peter Ostrushko's Polka Medley. Talked about how your towns were founded, who the founders were, how they got their names, and how you celebrate. Now, let's turn to the tough one. What are the challenges in the present day? Let's start with Pam Schwartz of the Boone County Historical Society.
I have a strange feeling that we all sort of have the same difficulties here and there, and I wouldn't necessarily call them problems. They're things that we're constantly working to overcome. You know, membership, you know, involvement. And I don't think it's that people aren't interested in history. I don't think it's that people don't want to be a part of our institutions or get involved in these different celebrations. I think it's 100% a matter of everybody has so darn much going on all the time. You know, everybody's got their kids' practices and there's church things and there's this group and that group. And so there's just a lot of civic options to be civically engaged in your community. And so I think a lot of times it's just a matter of, you know, finding enough of those resources and then funding. You know, funding is always the biggest thing. And, you know, I don't always want to just speak for everybody, but I feel like all of museums everywhere are in the same boat as nonprofits, and that, you know, it takes a lot of money. You know, some of our buildings are, you know, I have four structures that are over 100 years old. And so the maintenance that goes into
four
those,
structures
we
over
have,
100
yeah, we have four museums, you know, similar
so
to Story City.
So you don't have just the big building that I think of. There are other.
Yeah. I mean, the fourth floor Masonic temple takes a lot of love.
Really? Okay.
But then, yeah, also the Mamie Eisenhower birthplace. We have a rural schoolhouse, and we also have an old railroad depot down in Mungona. So, you know, I think if I was going to have to pick two of the biggest things like museums of the future really face, that's going to be just a decrease in membership and then also just trying to find ongoing funding because, you know, with maintenance and then trying to do these special celebrations, you know, everything costs money. These celebrations aren't free. Even if you have all volunteers, there's still costs associated with a lot of those, you know, centennial celebrations or sesquicentennials or any of these just annual things that we do.
Yeah, those are things that maybe you all could share something of. Is that typical for all of you, too? The funding, the challenge of buildings and maintenance and all this sort of thing. Kate looks like she's bursting to say that.
Well, we do have some of the same issues. Again, a lot of our buildings are over 100 years old as well. Finding grants, which there aren't as many as there used to be out there. There's a lot more people and museums competing for them, which is difficult as well. So, yeah, funding is always a big issue. And we have a really nice membership base in Story City and volunteers. We could always use more, though. You know, that's the thing.
You're not capping it at a certain number.
Right, definitely.
The more you have, the more you can do.
Exactly.
I mean, I guess that's the sort of overarching thing in museums, right, is, yeah, we could all just have beautiful exhibits and beautiful celebrations and everything, you know, if we had unlimited resources. But, you know, something I think a lot of the general public doesn't realize about grants, because I have a lot of people come in and say to me, oh, well, just get a grant for that. Well, if it was so easy, the thing about grants is that it's not just free money. You know, if I ask for $10,000, I often have to match that $10,000. And so where's that matching fund coming from? And I think not getting the grants necessarily is the hard part. It's being able to match those grants with other donor funding.
You know, I didn't know that. That's new to me. And I do know that writing grants is a skill in and of itself, that there are people who are very skilled at that, and they are valuable people to have around. And maybe all of you have participated in that process. Is that right? Each of you has been involved with grant writing. And, you know, those are terrific. But as you say, that carries a challenge, too. And looking at Story City, I'll compliment Kate here. She had a great series in the Herald about 1913. You know, you have these themes that come up, and that theme was, and probably no one ever thought that much about it, but it just seems that almost every building in Story City was built in 1913. Tell us about that, Kate, putting that series together.
Sure. We actually had the precursor to our Greater Chamber Connection, or GCC as we like to call it, our chamber office, was the commercial club. And they kind of formed in 1908 to boost, you know, the town and the businesses in the town. And by 1913, we had four major buildings built that year and 25 houses, which for the size of the town is just, it seems crazy to me. So basically, the theater that is 100 years old this year, our Story Theater, we had a sanitarium built for – it was a hospital and old people's home at
that
time.
That's my birthplace.
Yes.
And they tore it down, so I can't be president.
But the creamery in town also built a new building that year, and the bank building on the corner of Broad and Penn, where Ali's Pizza is today, was also built in 1913. So, but sometime between 1913, after all these were built, and I believe 1918, they put this flyer out. We have one of the original flyers, and they have photographs of each of the buildings after they were completed. So, but unfortunately, they would just say, I mean, you knew where the major four buildings were, obviously. That's not hard to tell. But for the homes, they would just be like, this is Mr. Johnson's house, which doesn't help me as to where it's located. So
you had to do the research and put together.
Right. We did some research. I did a lot of walking around Story City. I took my dog, so I didn't look like I was trying to creep on too many people.
What you did was a series of articles in the paper.
I did.
Which kept the Historical Society in the minds and hearts of people, because they were waiting to see what next week would bring.
Right.
And see, that's a good device.
Yeah. The 1913 Heralds were actually a really big help, too, because it was kind of – they had a local section, which I kind of compare to Facebook of today, where they would, you know, let people know what's going on with other people in town. So Mr. Johnson's home has his basement built today, that sort of thing. So that was nice to figure out. And my articles were kind of based on the 1913, you know, updates, if you will, on how
– today and then.
Right. So we got permission to have, you know, photographs taken of people's houses, for, you know, so you could compare and see how much they had changed over the last 100 years. So that was really interesting to see, too.
That was a great series. And Pam, you have in Boone, the famous Boone and Scenic Valley Railway. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch about how that great organization came to be?
I wish I actually knew more history about it. It kind of came down to, you know, with the changing of the railroad, which has morphed a lot in Boone, and where the lines were, which railroads came through and things like that. And it's actually based on the old Fort Dodge and Des Moines railroad line. And when they were just going to kind of tear it out, a few of the guys with an interest in the railroad or retired railroaders or current railroaders in town just said, you know, we're really missing an opportunity here to keep our railroad heritage. So they kind of took it upon themselves and started to deal with. And so we start with the Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad, which is just the line that, you know, you could get on and ride. And just here within, how long have I been around? The last about two and a half, three years, they've opened the James H. Andrews Museum with it, which is actually a large railroad collection from a gentleman out of Jefferson that found its way up to the Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad. And so now not only can you come and ride the train, and they have a lot of special rides each year. You know, they do the Thomas the Tank Engine Days, and those things are kind of their own celebration, too. But you can ride those, but you can also see a lot of really interesting railroad heritage within their museum, which is on the same location. So,
and you see that promoted on TV, those special trains, this dinner train.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of people come every year to ride that train. I mean, Thomas the Tank Engine, I want to say, is... I mean, I know it's over 10,000. I'm sure I'm, like, undercutting that severely.
And from all over
I don't
the world,
know.
Aren't they? Yeah. They come from all over the world.
Yeah, so.
And I think I heard that you have over there at the Scenic Railway something like 200 volunteers who were constantly involved in that.
Yeah, I think they do have quite a lot. I know we at the Society have close to 100, so I'm guessing that they easily have double that we do.
And what you have here is a community spirit, people who care enough to volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And you always have a lot of people who like to see things happen, and they love to come to the celebration. But I bet all of you would say the same thing, that there's a hardcore group of people, maybe 100 or 200 people, in every community that make things happen. It might be 50 people, but it's a core. And I'm and I'm looking here at Barb Mellinger. Tell us about your town and how volunteerism goes and what a challenge that might be sometimes.
Well, it is a challenge. We have a number of people who are the older citizens of town who know the history. They have the family names that have gone on for 100 years, and they are interested, and they are very supportive financially, but, you know, they are getting older too. Then we have a younger generation, and a lot of them are new people who have moved to town who don't have the history. And I know Huxley suffers from the same problem. They don't have the interest. They don't have the history. It's a bedroom town. They live there at night. They work during the day somewhere else. So it's hard to bring them in. And so having events and special activities and having a place to showcase them is very important. We're trying to keep our history going. We had a centennial yearbook, which is used all the time for researchers, and we are trying to put together a 125-year history with pictures and information and like a PowerPoint so it can be used in a number of different presentations. But one of the things that we're really focusing on is to be able to photograph different things in the town every year to make sure that we capture what's happening every year. And then the next part of it is, what do we save? We have a number of things that were saved from 100 years ago, from 50 years ago, but what do we save today? Everything seems to be throwaway. You know, you get a phone and tomorrow it's out of date, so you throw it away.
Not only that, documents. You know, we do email and electronic things that vanish. And you just have, if you look at our history nationally, just the correspondence of Thomas Jefferson, thousands of pages, you know.
Yep.
And a lot of people from that era, there's so much documentation that's been preserved. And you wonder, as you project into the future, and when we live in this electronic age, how much hard copy there's going to be.
That's exactly what we're talking about, and we'd like to have an exhibit on that to show that people sent valentines. People wrote letters. We have letters from soldiers in the Civil War, but we don't have letters from yesterday because people didn't write. Postcards were a big thing. You know, you communicated with postcards. But at the same time, 50 years ago or more, mail was delivered sometimes two or three times a day. So correspondence was the way – written correspondence was the way people communicated rather than electronic correspondence. So it's one of the things that we want to focus on is to preserve your written communication and encourage the young people of today to write things down, to write letters, to record your diaries.
Very interesting. These are things we don't think about until we actually process that and say, what kind of a world are we living in today, and how does that differ from a day when everyone wrote? For instance, a lot of schools don't teach cursive writing anymore.
That's correct.
You know, this is, Roland Story still does, because I know that I have a little boy I worked with. He said, my life is cursive. Cursive is my life. He really liked that stuff. But, you know, these are things that we look at, and we look at as a brand new era that's really incomparable to the most of the history, where the written form and hard copy was the norm until very recently. And now, Nels, your community is really expanding. There's so much new housing in Huxley. How is that impacting the historical society?
We have a monthly meeting, and we have about 10 people come every month. And of those 10, 7 of them are 80 years or older. So we've tried to get people to join and be active in it, but it's really difficult. We're lucky that the city of Huxley gave us a room in the Three C's building, which is a $4 million building with city hall, library, and a recreation place. So it doesn't cost us anything for expenses that way, but there's no way we could afford to have a separate place because we don't take enough money in to pay for the electricity or heat or anything. So,
and yet the folks you have are highly dedicated people, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
They're going to make sure that the history of Huxley is front and center.
And most of them are Norwegian heritage.
Hard-headed Norwegians who won't give up. Right?
I'm about the only one that isn't Norwegian of the group.
Is that right?
Yeah.
No, you say it's very interesting to hear the challenges and the things that are faced by establishing a historical society and preserving it and keeping the community interest up in all the events and things that you do, because we do live a fast-paced life. We are all busy. And I know that just generating a crowd for something like the Christmas tree lighting can sometimes really be a challenge, because people have such highly sophisticated entertainment in their homes now. I know several people who have theaters in their basement, you know. And so it's just hard to get people out to an event. So I salute you all for promoting and making sure these annual events happen and keeping them in the context of history and reminding people exactly where the town came from, how it got there, and that there are people like you and I and people who had feelings, people who had their own commitments. They were busy also and probably even more challenged by the difficulties of daily life. And yet, throughout this time, everyone and every community has been blessed with people who are civic-minded and care about the community and people who care about the things that have happened in the past and the people who've been important. I know one of the people in Story City my dad enjoyed was Hank Severide. Hank Severide was a ball player in the major leagues. And things were so small then and so intimate that in the off season he would come home and play with the boys, play baseball, you know. And so in Story City, here's this major league player, Hank Severide, and playing with the guys in town. Fantastic. My dad will never forget that. And that's the 1920s or whatever, you know. And I'm sure that every community has their hero, the person that came from that town that became notorious or famous or deserves to be commemorated. And also, when you look at the history of Iowa and the history of America, you have people coming from small towns. Look at all the great people that came from small towns. And we're talking about small towns and their heritage. And, man, Susan's here, too. And, Susan, I've left you out today. I've just running at the mouth. Now, you might have a question or two for our group here.
Well, I think you've asked all the questions that I figured out.
Yeah, she gave us guidance in what kind of questions to ask. But, you know, I just feel that history is so important, and each of these communities is so important. And we talk about the population loss in small towns. But here we are in the Golden Circle. Each of you is in a viable community, in the case of Huxley, growing immensely, and Story City's remaining stable. Boone is probably pretty stable or maybe growing.
Our county has been the same since 1880.
Is that right?
Yep.
The population
has been within 700 people or so.
Is that right?
Yeah, our population grew from 4,000-ish in 1865 to 20-some thousand. This is our whole county, mm-hmm. by 1880, and we're still around, right around 20 to 26,000.
Well, so. It would be interesting to know about Boone. Whenever you approach Boone from Highway 30, you drive past these beautiful big old houses on mm-hmm. the wide streets. You have pretty wide streets in Boone, too.
Yeah, they had an initiative for a while to do uh-huh. boulevards. That's it. That was kind of in the plan for a while, and that happened some places and not others. But yeah, Story Street is, you know, it's always been. I mean, Story Street, since the coming of Boone, has been the main street. And the address has changed at one point, which is kind of interesting. You know, what used to be one address then got shifted as the town grew and things changed a little bit. I mean, but that Story Street still has a lot. And just if you just drive around Boone, the houses, so many of them are still standing from the late 1800s that are just gorgeous, gorgeous big houses.
Oh, by today's standards, they're mansions. Story Street.
Oh, absolutely. It's just, you can't build like that anymore.
No, it's fantastic. I love driving up Story Street. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's very interesting. You have Story City and Boone, who are probably relatively stable populations who've grown quite a bit. Now, when I grew up in Story City, it was 1,500 people. Now, Kate, it's what, 3,000?
Right, like 3,000, 3,500, I think.
Yeah. But in the case of Huxley and Slater, you're into a real growth pattern as communities that are adjacent to commutable areas of work. And so you're seeing a different kind of environment. And it's funny because that really contrasts with the more established communities that are stable in population. And it might be a challenge for all these people who might be more transient to get interested in history and the community and its longevity and the background. So it's you're facing a different kind of situation in some ways in Slater and Huxley than is done in Story City and in Boone.
Thanks to all of you for coming in and sharing these very interesting pieces of the historical puzzle of Central Iowa. Pam Schwartz from the Boone Historical Society.
Thank you for having me.
And Barb Mallon from the Slater Area Historical Association.
Correct.
And Kate File from the Story City Historical Society, right?
That's correct. Thank you.
And Nels Nord, is that Huxley Historical Society?
Thank you.
And we've learned so much. Thank you so much for being with us. And now it's time to sign out, I think.
Yeah, this has been Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Hosts today have been Paul Wearson and Susan Franson. And remembering that our guests are also today Pam Schwartz, Kate File, Barb Mellon, Nels Nord. They are folks involved with the historical societies in their various communities.
Music you heard was Polka Medley by Peter Ostrusko from the CD Blue Mesa. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
You can also listen to this show and our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org, where we're streaming live. You'll find recent shows on our homepage with links to the organizations and other resources mentioned on our show. Our engineer today has been the wonderful Rebecca Brown.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and consider becoming one of the 500 families donating $20 per month or $250 per year to help us meet our operating expenses, though we'd appreciate whatever fits into your budget, just like historical societies. We'd also like to hear your feedback either by phone at 515-292-2878 or by email at khoiradio@gmail.com with news in the subject line, or stop in at the KHOI studios at 410 Douglas in Ames and say hello.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. And if you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878.
Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening today, and
see you again on the radio.